Global anxiety about the foot dragging on Capitol Hill. Today, Tuesday, October 15th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. World leaders are nervously watching our debt ceiling debate. Former Republican Senator Richard Lugar says that at a time of already heightened anxiety around the globe, America's fiscal and political crisis isn't helping.
For the United States to offer further anxiety is simply too much. Many people around the world, they count upon the United States for stability. I think they should.
Also, how the shutdown is affecting one translation company that used to consider the government a good client.
One of the reasons we've been doing it for the past 15 years is because we knew we would get paid. And that's changing now.
Plus, a reporter in Beijing on the latest fashion fad in China, couples in matching outfits.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's getting a little too close for comfort now. I'm talking about the debt ceiling debate. Our politicians now have less than 2 days to figure things out, or America will be staring default in the face come Thursday. Think about it. The U.S. failing to pay its debts for the first time in history. Later in the program, we'll hear about what that would look like to future students of U.S. history.
Looking at the outside world, it is just incredulity that the greatest power in the world cannot get its act together. And I think 1 year, 10 years, 100 years from now, that will still be something which is very hard to understand.
But we begin our coverage by focusing on the potential global ramifications now. Richard Lugar was a Republican senator from Indiana for 36 years and a foreign policy leader on Capitol Hill for much of that time.
I'm afraid that many of my former colleagues are not taking on the world view. This has been much more a debate about domestic issues, principally in the House of Representatives on so-called Obamacare, the Affordable Health Act that the Congress passed last year. In addition, there are, especially in the House, Republican members who believe that the debt ceiling is not that much of a crisis, that it would form a discipline for the United States to cut spending much more drastically. My view is that these members really do not have an overall sense, really, of either the foreign policy issues or the domestic ones when it comes to banking. But nevertheless, they are a strong cadre, and they threaten other members with primary elections in their states if they do not go along with this process.
There are people, we've had them on the program just yesterday, in Europe saying they can't believe this is happening in the U.S. So when you speak to those colleagues in other countries, how do you answer the question, how can a handful of Tea Party activists take not just a country, but kind of the world economy hostage right now?
Well, I try to explain to colleagues abroad what our political situation is. I think there are many in the United States who believe that our debt presently is too high, that budgets that have been adopted in the past have not been close to being balanced, and that as a result, we are increasing that debt and that trend has to be stopped. I think most of us agree with those general principles. The problem is in the details, working day by day. In other words, if we come to a point where the Treasury really is not able to borrow any more money, then there will be very sharp political ramifications in the United States, and that is likely to bring about congressional action in a hurry. Perhaps no one believes that that's going to happen, and I hope that they're right in that respect, but it certainly brings about a great deal of nervousness here and abroad.
So how do you think not just a shutdown, but a possible fiscal default are damaging U.S. interests around the world right now?
Well, default clearly would be very damaging. And in my own judgment, this is not going to occur.
I mean, whether the U.S. is fiscally responsible or not, I guess, is up for debate. But it seems that it's the reliability of the dollar that a lot of countries around the world see as the main kind of stability of the U.S. Is this moment, though, do you think, a sea change for the U.S. reputation economically around the world?
No, I don't believe it is a sea change. I believe, as I say, that we will not default as a country on our obligations. And as a matter of fact, that the dollar will still remain as the standard for most currencies. But there clearly is an anxiety, understandably, in the world where many countries, in Europe in particular, have been working in a very public way to try to bring stability, particularly in southern European countries, as well as perhaps in the European Union as a whole. There are problems elsewhere in Latin America that are very severe, that don't receive quite the same attention. This is simply a difficult period for the world in which huge adjustments are being made. And for the United States to offer further anxiety is simply too much for many people around the world to encompass. They count upon the United States for stability. I think they should.
Former Senator Richard Lugar, now running the Lugar Center in Washington. Our next story is about an industry that counts on the stability of government contracts. For several years, the translation industry has been booming, thanks in large part to an uptick in language service contracts from federal defense and intelligence agencies after 9/11. So how's that business doing now during the shutdown? Reporter Yoav Shaw visited a small language service company in Philadelphia to find out.
These days, if you expect to hear interpreting at the headquarters of a foreign language services company like Setra, don't hold your breath. Today, the most common business model is to hire translators and interpreters on a contract basis, oftentimes with the federal government as the client. That's Setra president and CEO Jiří Stejskal, introducing himself in his native language, Czech. Week three into the government shutdown, Stejskal has definitely seen better days.
We are directly affected by the government shutdown. Next week, we were supposed to be interpreting at a large conference in Hawaii. It has been canceled last minute. The equipment has been shipped. We have about 25 interpreters who have flight tickets and everything. It's just a total nightmare.
The large conference he mentioned is the 16th Annual Chiefs of Defense Conference, which the U.S. Pacific Command canceled only 13 days before it was supposed to start. Setra is counting on the $141,000 federal contract, which is now a big question mark.
It's been a little bit of a downer, to put it bluntly.
I was hoping to meet this guy, Thaddeus Thaler, at the office. He negotiates Setra's federal contracts, so he was in the D.C. area trying to get reimbursed by the federal government. I called him on Skype, and he told me that luckily, Setra's contract included a 100% refund policy, if the conference was canceled within 14 days of starting.
The reason why we have a 100% cancellation policy at that point is to ensure that our interpreters are paid for those days, regardless of the situation, because it's so difficult for them to have to go out and find new work. Otherwise, they're going to be out several hundred dollars, if not more, for those number of days that they miss.
But even with that policy, it's not clear yet that Setra will get all of its money back, or that the feds will cover the cost of the interpreter's fees. The Defense Department notified Setra that the conference was canceled due to the shutdown, much to the surprise of Antonio Guerra, Setra's director of interpreting services.
I was very shocked to find out that this was considered non-essential military activity. And I think it's a very important event. It's a very important conference, and I've seen it year after year.
This year would have been Guerra's fourth time at the high-level conference, which brings together the chiefs of defense from 37 Asia-Pacific countries on a yearly basis.
The purpose of the conference is to promote cooperation and stability in the Asia-Pacific region. So they'll want to talk about issues like climate change, the economy, terrorist factions in Indonesia, the Fukushima plant in Japan, and the impact of the radiation going into the Pacific Ocean.
In a somewhat cruel twist of irony, the very same day that Setra got news of the canceled conference, they had an audit done by the Federal General Services Administration. Setra's president, Jiří Stejskal, told me that an auditor came to visit.
So he spent 3 or 4 hours in our office. So that piece of government seems to be up and running happily.
Oh, so you sound a little bitter.
Even with the threat of a U.S. debt default looming, Setra is in a better position right now than other foreign language companies that provide services only to the federal government. Federal contracts make up roughly a third of Setra's business, But Stayskull says he's thinking of reducing that number in the future because of the shutdown.
Did you ever expect anything like this to happen?
Well, this would be the last thing I would expect. So yeah, it came to us as a total surprise. We've been serving federal government for close to 15 years now. And even though it's a difficult client, especially given all the bureaucracy and red tape, but one of the reasons we've been doing it for the past 15 years is because we knew we would get paid. And that's changing now.
For The World, I'm Yowei Shaw in Philadelphia.
Listen to more of The World's language stories at PRI.org/language. Sometimes fashion trends don't translate well from one culture to another. Then again, sometimes they do. Take this trend, couples who wear matching outfits. We've seen it before in this country, but it's kitschy beyond belief and has never really been a fad here. Well, what's out here is now apparently in China. The Wall Street Journal's Laurie Burkett in Beijing has been following this trend for quite a while and has just written about it. She says it's especially hard to miss Chinese couples who dress alike in the summer.
You see probably, in a 15-minute span, at least three couples are wearing the similar outfits. And it has really just become a fashion trend of stating someone's feelings on the outside. And I talked to a number of different couples who basically said, you know what, this is our statement. We want people to know we love one another, and this is what we're choosing to do. So in the U.S., you might wear wedding rings, and in China, you're going to wear matching outfits.
I mean, I can't get my head away from thinking of millions of Chinese couples wearing matching Christmas sweaters, but surely that's not what's happening here. What are the couples wearing?
Hey, they've gotten pretty fashionable. You can actually see couples wearing, sometimes it's like these hip Adidas outfits where they look like they're getting ready to go play soccer together. Sometimes there's a little more subtlety to it. There's shirts that play off of one another. You know, it's sort of the old I'm with stupid idea, only much more endearing. But then there's also like matching dress and suits. You've got outfits for the whole family that include grandma and grandpa. I have to say it's a little bit dorky, but it comes across as pretty cute when you hear all the feeling that's behind it.
I mean, couples are one thing, but when you get to the whole family and everybody dressing the same way, I mean, does that echo at all for anybody, the cultural revolution under Mao, which embraced the tyranny of a single uniform?
One couple I interviewed, they joked around with me and they said, well, our parents do wear matching outfits, and everyone back in the Cultural Revolution did. So maybe it was all this sort of couples outfit and everyone was in love. But no, I think in general, people don't connect the two because these generations who are doing it now are so far removed from the cultural generation era. But I do sometimes wonder if you've got the older folks looking at the younger crowd and thinking, huh, we used to do that, but it meant something very different.
And what happens if the couples break up? Do they just retire that Adidas warm-up suit, hang it way up in the closet somewhere?
That's a very good question. And it's one that I have to say I started reporting the story actually almost a year ago in hopes of trying to find a couple that would break up. And in fact, I found one. One of the people I spoke to, the female of the couple, she said, I would rather wear dirty laundry. I would never wear this shirt. So they don't go so far as to throw it away. I think they tuck it away in a little cupboard or something and dig it out for the desperate laundry times. But yeah, it still remains in their little keepsake boxes.
Unlike a diamond ring, you can't really take a tracksuit down to the pawn shop, can you?
Exactly.
The Wall Street Journal's Laurie Burkett in Beijing. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
Still ahead on the show, if you can sing well, you might be able to become Korean on The World from PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Violent attacks around the globe are sadly all too common. Sometimes they don't even make the news here. One incident in Myanmar caught our attention, in part because we heard about it directly from someone who was nearby at the time. It happened last night in the largest Burmese city, Rangoon. As you've heard here on The World, Myanmar seems to be a real success story, a nation transitioning from dictatorship to struggling democracy. There are fancy hotels now in Burma, though the infrastructure is still a bit rough.
Here in Burma, the internet is just so underdeveloped, let's say, that, you know, Traders is known for having the best internet in the city. I mean, my newspaper, we're even located close to Traders in case something happens to our internet. We go to Traders Hotel. And I can tell you that it's quite pricey for them. It costs them, I think, about more than $5,000 a month for their fast internet, the kind of internet that we in the U.S. kind of take for granted.
That's Naomi Gingold, a reporter for the Irrawaddy newspaper. She was in the Traders Hotel last night, taking advantage of the fast internet there, when she heard a man screaming for help.
And he appeared carrying this woman limp down the stairs, and she was bleeding kind of profusely. There was blood on the ground, and a black van finally appeared at the doorway, and they brought her out and took her out to the hospital. And her two little sons somehow ended up in my care. I was there and with one other journalist, and we kind of ended up taking care of them. They were pretty shaken, really cute 5- and 7-year-old, and they were only wearing T-shirt and underwear, and the hotel staff brought them a towel, and we kind of talked to them, calmed them down a little bit.
Did you immediately know that there had been a bomb attack? I mean, it sounds like you didn't hear anything.
It wasn't immediately clear what exactly had happened to her. We thought maybe she was sick. We had no idea that there had been an explosion yet, because there was no big sound. We'd only heard the guy screaming. And it wasn't until we left that night, we got the boys some hot chocolate. We talked to them a little bit, joked with them, and put them to bed. And we were leaving the hotel, and we noticed the glass kind of strewn around, kind of far out from the entrance of the hotel, almost to the street. And that's when we realized something wasn't quite right, and they hadn't told us the whole story.
So, Naomi, who might have done this, and why would they have done it? Has there been any claim of responsibility?
You know, that's what's so weird about this, is that there have been absolutely no claims as to what's going on. We don't really know yet so far. This actually is following kind of a string of attacks that have occurred in Rangoon over the last couple days, and there have been a few bomb blasts in other cities in the country as well. Burma's had ethnic insurgencies for a long time. You know, in the past, when there have been some small explosions in the country in years past, you know, they were often blamed on the insurgencies. Some reporters think this might be tied to the fact that last week, some, you know, military strongmen in the government kind of made threatening statements saying that if the constitution were changed, there would be serious consequences in the country. I mean, what people are saying are all over the place at the moment. What has been kind of confirmed, I should say, is that there are three suspects that the police are currently talking to in Rangoon. It's unclear why they've been arrested, unclear what the evidence is against them. And there was one man arrested in another state. He was apparently seen on a security camera at Traders Hotel and left his ID in a taxi.
I mean, just that notion, though, about the general you mentioned who was dissatisfied with the changes to the Constitution. I mean, is that a current that you're finding in Burma among some people, that they don't like the idea of democracy being brought into their country?
I think most people here in Burma really want democracy and change, though I should say that a lot of people tell me that nothing has really changed. The generals have just changed clothes.
Reporter Naomi Gingold on the line from Rangoon. Thank you for your time, Naomi. Good to speak with you.
Thanks very much, Marco.
And to get a sent report, Naomi had to go back to Traders to file because her own internet wasn't fast enough. Oh, and she got back to us to say that the woman injured in the blast is okay and has flown with her husband and kids to their home in Hong Kong. As for that bomb, details of who did it and why are still unclear. The details are also unclear in this next story. Several days ago, a human rights group devoted to protecting political cartoonists around the globe reported that a detained Syrian cartoonist was dead. But once that news was posted, many people responded via Facebook and Twitter that no, he's alive and still in prison. How to verify? Well, that is the problem. The World's cartoon editor Carol Hills is with us. Carol, what is going on here?
Well, it's really tough, because what happened was this cartoonist, his name is Akram Roslin. He was a cartoonist in Hama. He worked for a government newspaper, as everyone in Assad, Syria does. So Roslin started doing anti-Assad cartoons, but on his own time, and he posted them on Facebook. And that's where the Assad regime saw them, and he was arrested in October 2012. No one's heard from him since, not his family, not anyone. And so this report comes along 5 days ago from a human rights group, as you mentioned. People say, oh, no, he's still alive. So the issue is, Akram Roslin is in a security prison. He's not in a regular prison, so no one can find out. Meanwhile, the Twitter sphere, social media, everybody's going back and forth. But no one can really verify it in a way that will satisfy people.
So how did the reports that Akram Roslin is dead come about in the first place?
Well, Cartoonist Rights Network International, they have very good sources inside Syria and outside Syria. And they got word that Roslin had been executed, that there was a show trial maybe in June or July. And after he was convicted in the sham trial, they're leading him to prison. And he was pulled out from the line along with some others who were arrested and killed. And so that's what they posted. They made it conditional. They said this is what they've heard. But it's very difficult to verify it. And so I decided to call another person. I made a bunch of calls today. And one was to a Syrian journalist who's now living in Norway, Masoud Akko. And he is a human rights activist. And he also has heard from his sources. And his sources talked to political prisoners who'd been released, who said, he's dead. And they couldn't describe to him how he died, but that he's dead. He could have died from an illness. He could have been executed. It's completely unclear. But this person told another activist inside Syria, an anonymous activist, that Akram Roslin is dead. But we don't know how. But it's just not enough to satisfy those on the outside. And the really sad, difficult thing in this is that Akram Roslin's family, they are not accepting that he's dead. They're saying, no, he's still alive. Mm. And other people are, too. And so we can't get any verification.
It also certainly can't help that Akram Roslin is not a widely known cartoonist. He used to write and draw for state media in Syria, Assad's own media. Then, as you say, he started criticizing the state. I mean, how common is that story among Syrian cartoonists these days?
Well, it's interesting. You recall Ali Ferzat, a famous Syrian caricaturist. So Ali Ferzat, Akram Roslin, they work for government-run newspapers. Both of them, at a certain point, once the uprising started to lose any kind of coding or symbols in their cartoons and just went for it and started criticizing very bluntly Bashar al-Assad. And in Ali Ferzat's case, he was beaten savagely. He now lives outside of Syria. He recovered. In the case of Akram Roslin, we don't know. It's just not clear how this particular case or many others will be resolved.
Carol Hills follows political cartoons and other topics here at The World. You can see more of Akram Roslin's work, which has landed him in trouble. That's at PRI.org. Carol, thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Imagine you're a globetrotting veterinary scientist. You'd be pretty excited to find a new species of tick, right? Well, sure, unless you have to pull that tick out of your nose.
And I made use of a mirror, a flashlight, and a forceps to remove it.
All in the name of science. That story ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It takes more than a shutdown to keep people from becoming new U.S. citizens. The federal agency responsible for swearing in new citizens has mostly stayed open, although some naturalization ceremonies have been delayed. But still, what's a little shutdown delay compared to living the dream of so many immigrants to these shores? You know, reaping the benefits of officially becoming an American citizen. This week, as part of our Global Nation coverage of our changing America and its people, we're exploring what citizenship means exactly, and that's why we've invited Peter Spiro to join us. He's a law professor at Temple University and the author of Citizenship, American Identity After Globalization. Peter, you've written about the changing benefits of citizenship today in the U.S. and, say, what Americans had in the early 20th century. What's different then and now? Is there more rights, fewer rights today?
In your setup, you mentioned the dream of becoming an American citizen. Well, I'm not sure how much that's the dream these days. It's more a dream of a green card and the right to stay in the United States. Citizenship itself doesn't get you much, and it doesn't ask much from you. And so I think there's been a real departure from the old trope of the rights and obligations of citizenship to a much less meaningful status.
Well, give me an example. I'll take my own grandfather who came here in the late 1800s from what's now Ukraine. What would he have gotten when he arrived at Ellis Island or just landed in Manhattan back then that if he came today, he just wouldn't like even be looking at?
The disabilities of not having citizenship were greater. So, for instance, if you weren't a citizen, even as a legal immigrant to the United States, there were many, many professions that you were barred from joining. So you couldn't become a lawyer. You couldn't become a doctor. You couldn't own a pool hall. In some states, you couldn't even own land until you became a citizen. So the step between being an immigrant and being a citizen was an important one by way of advancement. Today, green card holders, permanent resident aliens, they pretty much get everything that citizens get. There are really only two exceptions now. One is the vote. But you can participate even as a non-citizen in the political process in many ways, including by donating money. So if you're a green card holder, you can donate money up to the same extent that a citizen can donate money to a federal election campaign. Mm. Many would say that that's a much more powerful way of participating in the political system than the vote is. The other right that still persists is one of absolute locational security. So if you're a citizen, you can't be deported.
You know, back in the day when people thought utopias were still possible, ha-ha, he laughs, people used to talk about global citizenship. There was even a movement to create a global mm-hmm. passport. Where for you does that idea kind of figure into any discussion of citizenship?
The very concept of world citizenship is problematic. Citizenship implies that there's one group of people that distinguishes itself from another group of people. So difference is inherent to citizenship. What I think is going to happen as national citizenship begins to decline, that other forms of association are starting to rise up and compete with identity with the state. So I would put the environmental movement or world religions or world political movements as new competitors to the state for really the loyalties of individuals.
But isn't there really a huge difference between kind of self-identification and legal identification?
Well, the state still gets you something. It still gets you a passport. It's as a form of insurance almost. That I've got that passport. I know I can come back to the U.S. and nobody can take it away from me. But legally and otherwise, citizenship actually means much less than it used to. So beyond that locational security and the right to go into the ballot box, there's not that much that citizenship actually gets you.
Peter Spiro, a law professor at Temple University and author of Citizenship, American Identity After Globalization. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco. I enjoyed talking to you.
Well, it may not get you as much as it used to, but plenty of undocumented immigrants want a path to citizenship. This week, we'll examine what that path looks like today, including some of the obstacles immigrants face and why some are saying, nah, I'll pass on citizenship altogether. We start with a look at citizenship tests. For many countries, they're the final barrier to becoming naturalized. Sam Harnett takes a tour of exams around the globe.
Let's start with one of the toughest places to get citizenship, the Vatican City. About 500 people have Vatican citizenship, and they're mostly cardinals, diplomats, and Swiss guards. There's no exam. The basic condition is that you work for the state. This is an extreme example of national unity. Yet, at some level, all countries push new citizens to integrate. And that's where citizenship tests come in. They normally have a civics and a language section.
The basic idea is that this test of language ability and some history and government will bring them this civic nationalism or social cohesion.
Anthony Koonin teaches English literature at Singapore's Nanyang Technology University. He's considered the go-to academic on citizenship tests. He says the exams try to instill a country's ethos. Take Japan's test.
The general requirement is that you should have a certain amount of Japanese-ness.
How you prove that, Koonin says, isn't so clear. South Korea is more direct. The emphasis is on language skills: reading, writing, speaking, and singing. Yep, to pass, you need to belt out South Korea's national anthem. Kunin says this high language bar makes the test hard for South Korea's large Chinese immigrant population. And by the way, that's not an immigrant singing. It's K-pop star Ga Yoon at a soccer match. Kunin says countries implement citizenship tests when there's a concern about immigration. Wealthy nations generally have them. Poor ones don't. He says the U.S. had one of the first tests in the 80s, and other countries followed suit. Tim McNamara is a linguistics professor at Melbourne University. He's studied the trend. His conclusion? The tests are political.
It seems to me that the function of the test really is to achieve something politically for the mainstream parties.
For instance, France's socialist government is working to help more people pass its citizenship test, while England's conservative government recently made its test harder. Applicants now face tough cultural questions about Kipling, the Beatles, and Monty Python. Yeah, that's right, the Flying Circus.
Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Okay, sure, that's Britishness to a T. But why the Beatles instead of the Kinks or the Clash? Why Kipling instead of Larkin or Plath? Because the exams aren't constructed using the science of standardized testing, critics call them arbitrary. Just grab bags of cultural trivia forced on immigrants by those in power. For example, McNamara says applicants in Australia used to have to know about a famous cricket player because the Prime Minister liked the game.
The previous Prime Minister, John Howard, was a cricket fan, and he believed that any sort of decent Australian needed to know who Don Bradman was.
Critics say the questions often lack enough context to make them meaningful, like this one from the Dutch test.
Question number 33. Waarom is Anne Frank beroemd? So why was Anne Frank famous?
Massimiliano Spotti is a professor at Tilburg University in the Netherlands. He says immigrants don't learn that Anne Frank was a Holocaust victim, nor that she died at a concentration camp. Instead,
the answer that is given afterwards is Ze schreef een dagboek, translated, she has written a diary.
A diary that doesn't quite capture the whole picture. Spotti says the bigger issue with these tests is that they impose a kind of top-down definition of cultural identity.
These questions, they do spell out what is the canonical knowledge that someone should have in order to live in benevolence.
Professor Kunin adds the public has limited input into that definition. He says the tests are created and evaluated largely behind closed doors. And without citizenship, immigrants have little power to push for transparency. For The World, I'm Sam Harnett.
Want to see how you do on Britain's new citizenship test? Head to our website, PRI.org. We've got a link to a sample quiz created by the Guardian newspaper. And tomorrow we take a critical look at the U.S. citizenship exam. So I heard one end of a pretty weird phone conversation earlier today. It started with one of our producers saying this. Professor Goldberg, congratulations on your nose tick. Yeah, nose tick, like that needs congratulating. But on the other end of the line was Tony Goldberg. He's a veterinary epidemiologist at the University of Wisconsin and studies how some diseases can make the jump from primates to humans. Professor Goldberg joins me now from Madison. Professor, whose nose was this where this tick was found?
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, it was my own nose.
How big a deal is this nose tick that you found?
That's a good question. So in terms of the size of the tick itself, not a very big deal because it was about the size of a pencil eraser. But scientifically, I think it has implications that go beyond the individual tick that was up my right nostril.
All right. So I want to know what we can learn from this tick. First of all, how do you think it arrived in your nose? Where did it come from?
Geographically, it came from Africa. So I do research on zoonotic diseases, diseases that are transmitted between animals and people. And that work takes me to equatorial Africa and specifically to Uganda, to a wonderful park in the western part of the country called Kibale National Park, which is known for its biodiversity. And in the course of my research, I spend quite a bit of time in the forest where primates live, non-human primates, monkeys and chimpanzees. And that's where I acquired this tick. I didn't realize I had it until after I'd returned to the United States and was sitting in my lab. And that's when I noticed a slight pain in my right nostril. And I'd experienced that type of pain before, so I had a pretty good idea of what it was. And I made use of a mirror, a flashlight, and a forceps to remove it. I was fortunate to be able to grasp it firmly by the mouth parts and pull, and I got the tick in its entirety out of my nose, sparing most of the surrounding nose hairs.
Congratulations on that as well.
Thank you. It was a feat of manual dexterity, let me tell you.
And this picture we have at PRI.org shows this thing, all translucent, belly nice and bloated, just like the Big Mama ticks we all remember from our childhoods. What for you is the important thing about having this tick? What can we learn from this?
In doing DNA analysis of this tick, we realize that its DNA sequences do not exist in any current databases. It may be a known species that's never been sequenced genetically, or it may be a new species. Either way, though, I think the cool thing about this tick from my perspective is how it makes its living in nature. Probably what these ticks are chimp ticks. And this makes perfect sense because chimps are crazy about grooming. So chimps groom each other fastidiously. So if you're a tick on a chimp, you're at high risk of being groomed off unless you can find a place to hide. So what better place than deep inside the nose? Because even though chimps pick their noses, they don't pick each other's noses. So if you can get to the nose, you're likely safe. So our working hypothesis here is that these are chimp nose ticks that occasionally get onto people and, as unpleasant as it sounds, crawl up your body and across your face to get into your nose on purpose.
Can I ask you what would have happened to you, to a chimp, if this tick crawls up your nose and you don't get it out? I mean, we're freaked out by Lyme disease spread by ticks here in the Northeast. I mean, is there anything that you think might be associated with this tick you found in your nose from Uganda?
Well, we don't have any evidence that this particular tick had any diseases in it. I feel fine. I have a slightly elevated craving for bananas, but other than that, everything's normal. But we do know that this genus of tick, Amblyomma, does carry some nasty diseases, some bacterial, rickettsial, and viral diseases elsewhere in Africa and in other parts of the world. So it's possible this tick could be a vector for diseases. And that's one of the other interesting things about this finding. We're still learning about the different pathways that diseases can use to move between wildlife and people. And this nose tick is a slightly amusing and particularly gross example of how diseases move in nature. It falls under the idea of ecology of infectious diseases. So we're still learning about the ecological pathways, and this is one.
Professor Tony Goldberg, veterinary epidemiologist at the University of Wisconsin, congratulations for real, and thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
If you're a candy connoisseur, then this little tune might ring a bell or drive you a little crazy. That's the theme song for Haribo, you know, the little gummy bears that, if you believe the song, make kids and adults equally happy. Since Haribo started in 1920, the German companies turned those little bears into a huge global brand. How big? Well, Haribo claims to make 100 million bears each day. And the man who helped make those treats, a household name from Albania to Zambia, Hans Riegel, the son of the company's founder. Riegel and his brother Paul helped pick up the pieces of the company after World War II. Both of them had been Allied prisoners of war. Hans took over marketing, Paul focused on production. The company now employs more than 6,000 people and has production sites across Europe. The growth did not come without controversy, though. In 2000, Haribo was criticized for refusing to donate to a fund compensating forced laborers during the Nazi era. News came today that Hans Riegel died in Bonn, Germany. He was 90. Germany's foreign minister Guido Westerwelle paid him tribute. Wherever I traveled in the last few years, Westerwelle said, the little gold bears had already long been there. Well, personally, I'm a fizzy cola guy. They fight less in the bag than the bears. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Today, 2 days away from debt ceiling default, here's about the only thing I can tell you to make you feel better about your government. If this happens, the U.S. won't be the first economic superpower to do so. Historians and economists often mention Imperial Spain. We are talking 400 or so years ago, that is. Back then, Spain was the world's economic, political, and military powerhouse. from Manila to Mexico City and from Mumbai to Naples and Lisbon, all bowed to the will of the Habsburgs. So what went wrong? Well, Jeffrey Parker has studied that question for years. The globetrotting historian is now professor at Ohio State University in Columbus. So what fiscal problems did Spain's Habsburgs rulers run into, Jeffrey Parker?
They run into much the same problem as any global superpower, whether it's today or 400 years ago, imperial overstretch. You can get away with spending more than you make for some of the time, but you can't do it for all of the time. The problem is that it's easier to start wars than to finish them, as we have found out ourselves in the 21st century. It's the same with Spain. They spend millions and millions and millions of ducats, and someone has to provide it.
So what I want to know is whether there's a lesson from Spain 400 years ago for the U.S. today. I mean, and is there a lesson here? It sounds like you're saying there might be a lesson about never-ending war.
Yeah, don't start a war. Don't believe those who say, oh, it'll be over by Christmas. Oh, as soon as we arrive as liberators, they'll be putting roses in the barrels of our guns. It just doesn't happen that way.
So let's circle back to Spain. I mean, what were the consequences of Spain defaulting those early years? I mean, the lenders survived, but what was the cost to the Spanish realm?
The lenders do not survive.
Oh.
The lenders do not survive. Some of the lenders do. You see, you have a terrible carrot and stick dilemma. If you've lent money to the Spanish government and it defaults, the government will come to say, well, if you lend us a little bit more, we will in fact start repaying the debt we already owe you. And some bankers go for that. And of course, they just get sucked in deeper. And the next time there's a default, they lose even more. Others say, absolutely not. We are not going to go down that way. And they lose everything.
And can a country ever kind of pull out of that? I mean, and how long did it take Spain to kind of get back to?
Spain, amazingly, continues to find bankers. There are enough bankers who are not prepared to. It's very difficult, you know, to say goodbye to your assets. It's very, very. It's a very bold decision to say, you know, we have spent so much, but we now realize we made a terrible mistake and we're just going to draw a line under that investment. We're not going to lend anymore.
I mean, whether the debt ceiling is defaulted on or not, I mean, you're a historian, Jeffrey Parker. What do you think people are going to be saying about the United States in 400 years?
You can tell perhaps from my accent, although I've lived in this country since 1986, I'm not a native-born American. I am a citizen. I pay my taxes here and I vote. But looking at the outside world, it is just incredulity that the greatest power in the world cannot get its act together. I mean, to link the default on sovereign debt, something which really does tarnish a country, to a particular piece of legislation which has already passed, I don't think anyone outside the United States can understand that. How we could be holding the economy of the world to ransom in return for some concessions on a piece of legislation which is already passed. You know, what is there still to discuss? That's what I think the rest of the world can't understand. And I think 1 year, 10 years, 100 years from now, that will still be something which is very hard to understand.
A fair point indeed. And now we have to say goodbye to our asset, Jeffrey Parker, professor of history at Ohio State University in Columbus. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You've heard a lot of music from Mali on the world. That's because music in that part of West Africa is an ancient tradition with many players who continue to make it a living and breathing art form.
Malian music is so sophisticated. It's so complex and so interesting and so evolved that it would be a little bit presumptuous just to sort of walk in after a few days in the country and say, yeah, I know how to sort this stuff out.
That's Brian Eno, rocker, composer, and all-around musical curiosity seeker. He's in Mali right now, along with some European musicians who are collaborating with Malian artists. And they're about to take the next leg of an ongoing cultural exchange known as Africa Express. Two musical cultures get together on a train or a bus, and they tour around performing in venues often small and out of the way. Eno is right. Malian music is complex and has been years in the making. And I want to introduce you now to a musician who's keeping it a living, breathing art form, Sidi Touré. When war broke out in Mali last year, Muslim extremists placed a ban on music, among other things. And yet musicians are so central to life in Mali, it wasn't easy to act as if music no longer existed. Singer-songwriter Sidi Touré says that the confusion for many Malians began when the war started.
C'est des peuples qui ont vécu ensemble depuis les temps immémoriaux.
He told me that war in northern Mali prior to last year just didn't make sense. War was always a last resort. For ages, he says, we've gotten along. We've seen people from the Sarai tribe marry Tuareg people, and Arabs have married Tuaregs and vice versa. So war shouldn't have happened. But it did, he says. You can hear the joy of life as it should be in a song like this one, Ai Ora, or My Dance. Contrast that with the realism of Sidi Touré's take on the war. It doesn't matter if it's Arabs or Tuaregs. It's the people on the bottom who suffer the most, he says. I can't tell you how awful it made me feel to watch Malians last year flee their towns, Sidi Touré says. It's like they became homeless beggars. Nothing, says Touré, can replace where you are born. And that reveals more about his music than almost anything else he can say, because Sidi Touré's music is about home. A quick glance of his songs on his new album, Alafia, reads like a short list of everyday life in Mali. In English, you've got tunes titled The Water, The Butcher, The Army, Street Medicines. It's all there. I asked Sidi Touré this question. What do you think the world did not understand about the war in Mali? And his answer began with a proverb used amongst his Sorai people in Mali. When three birds fly by, he says, it's impossible to hear how beautifully each one sings. You have to listen to each bird individually if you want to hear its voice. And that's like the war in Mali, he says. During the worst fighting, the world could not distinguish all the different voices from inside the country. But then Malians finally got help from the outside to return to relative peace, and the world is better able to listen to all the voices now. La paix. So we leave you today with the voice of Sidi Touré and a song called La Paix, or Peace. This version he performed exclusively for us. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening.
Wanguma kate virki gandara Wanguma kate bori matabushi Kahambure zumandi gandara la paix atombuktu.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.